Welcome to Radio Sefarad's English Corner. I'm your host, Linda Jimenez, bringing news and other features of Jewish interest to Radio Sefarad's English-speaking audience in Spain and around the world. Our trivia question for this week is, how many people have participated in Yiddish Farms classes and in their farm tours? Yiddish Farm is located in Goshen, New York, about 60 miles or 100 kilometers northwest of New York City. There's a large Jewish population in the area, including ultra-Orthodox Hasidic communities such as Kiryas Joel, as well as secular communities. Yiddish Farm was founded in December 2010 as part of the growing movement to revive Yiddish, which in 1939 was the primary language of over 75% of the world's Jews. The original idea was to create a Yiddish-speaking environment in which people from all backgrounds could learn and practice the language in the natural setting of working on a farm. In 2012, we spoke with Naftali Edelman, the educational director, and Yisrael Bas, the farm manager, about the budding venture. Yiddish Farm recently celebrated its 10th anniversary, and this week Yisrael Bas is speaking with us about how the project has evolved.
Thank you very much for speaking with us today. Our first program was in 2012, and Yiddish Farm was very new and just getting off the ground, and there were only two of you there. You were the farm manager, and Naftali Edelman was the education manager. I was wondering if your own role has changed at all, and if there are more people working there now.
Yeah, I mean, roles have constantly been changing. Our first program was in 2011, actually. It wasn't here in Goshen. We rented a cabin at the Pearl Stone Jewish Retreat Center in Maryland. And that program, I was program coordinator for. And it was more of like, I was describing it recently to somebody. It was almost like a Yiddish, like salon almost. It was very different than what Yiddish Farm actually became. That first year, we invited only people that spoke Yiddish already to come. And the idea that the Pearl Stone Retreat Center also had a farm. So there was some farming component, learning farming vocabulary. Even people who speak Yiddish don't necessarily know all the names of the plants and vegetables and tools and things like that. And then in the afternoons, we were learning French in Yiddish. And we were cooking together and watching Yiddish movies and all kinds of having, you know, guest lecturers come in, guest cooks come in. It was very like a high-level cerebral program. So when we moved to Goshen, there was a lot of work to do. The property, it basically was a disaster. The property had been not really well-maintained for a very long time. It's zoned farmland, but there wasn't really a farm left here. The dairy had closed in 1982, I think. The farmhouse had burned down around the same time. The fields were mostly overgrown. There really wasn't much of a farm to speak of. So in order to have a farm, a lot of work had to go into getting things cleared and planted, and that just took tremendous effort. So I kind of took that on to do that. And that farm that we ended up setting up that summer, which was originally we thought we were going to be in one field, and then that field got flooded and we had to go to a different field. And our neighbor helped us clear that field. He had tractors and stuff. We didn't have any equipment really. So he helped us out and we got the field cleared and we planted a pretty sizable garden of lots of different vegetables. And that was where our students did their farming that summer of 2012. And then by 2012, also, the demand for programming / the funding situation had changed. And so far as over the winter of 2011 going into 2012, Naftali was getting a lot of calls saying, hey, you know, we'd love to learn Yiddish on a farm, as opposed to what we had done the year before, which was people who already know Yiddish learning about farming, discussing, you know, philosophy, learning other languages, talking about a vision for a, you know, intentional community and things like that, and that had kind of shifted to, hey, how about Yiddish education? And because Naftali has a background in Yiddish education, his family had a background in Yiddish education, there seemingly was more money available for those kind of programming. And also that students would be paying tuition to come, as opposed to people who spoke Yiddish already. A lot of them wanted a job here, but they didn't necessarily want to pay to participate in some kind of other program. So all those kind of factors coalesced in the summer of 2012, and we did our first beginner's Yiddish program, which ended up, I think, being like a 14-week program. And there wasn't like a more advanced section where some of our friends who had been studying Yiddish for a couple of years did attend towards the end of the summer. And that's how things took off in 2012 here in Goshen.
Let's talk about how it's evolved. First, let's talk about the farming. That year, as you said, you raised a lot of different kinds of vegetables, and you said you were going to talk about raising geese, and there were two goats there at the time. Do you have any animals now?
We actually just got a fresh chicks in the mail yesterday. So my kids are very excited about them. And we're thinking about bringing back maybe a goat or two later this summer. I have a friend that raises goats that we might be able to borrow a goat or two for the summer. We tried everything in the beginning. I mean, we did geese for a couple of years. We did other poultry, turkeys, chickens. That garden that we had was mixed vegetables. That fall, we planted a tremendous amount of garlic. We were expecting to have a contract with Whole Foods, and then that fell apart. We ended up selling to ShopRite. We've tried a lot of things. The thing that's been the most constant was in the fall, I want to say 2011, but maybe it was 2012, we planted our first plot of wheat, almost as like a test plot. It was like 100 by 50 by maybe 25 foot hand sown plot. And we saw that it grew. And we're like, hey, we could grow wheat here. And that led us to the year after planting even bigger fields of wheat. And it was really easy compared to all these other things because the county has a seeder that is like a $25,000 machine that they just rent out for like $100. So once we had a tractor in the fall of 2012, we were able to till a bigger field, plant wheat. We had no idea how we were going to harvest it, but the idea was to make matzahs, which we're still making to this day, and it's proven very popular with that wheat. And then, you know, we slowly acquired the equipment we needed to do it a lot more efficiently when we first started growing wheat. Our first big harvest was 2013. It took everybody, all the students, all the volunteers, maybe like 20 people to get it all in, and it was insane. And then it ended up being a very special experience for whoever was here. And now it's really easy. We could do it with like two or maybe, you know, three people, the whole harvest. So we've made it a long way in terms of having the right things in place to be able to do it. And in the meantime, I mean, we've been growing other vegetables and things in the meantime also. But the wheat has been the constant and the matzahs have been the constant.
Tell us about the matzah.
So the idea with the matzah was more just like a friend of mine gave me a bag of seeds for wheat. And when we were first starting out, and I said, okay, I'll try this. And all the how to farm books, or you could be a farmer too books, they all say, stay away from grains, that don't do anything with grain. You know, there's these guys that write books, do pasture poultry, do a market garden, do it. We tried all those things, but it was a tremendous amount of work. Grain is also a tremendous amount of work, but fortunately, the machines exist at a reasonable price to be able to do it a little bit more efficiently without tremendous amounts of sweat constantly. So, and it seemed like a natural fit for us because we're a Jewish farm, a Yiddish farm, that we'd be doing something that has a Jewish aspect to it. Corn and potatoes, and yeah, you can say, you know, we made our own potato kugels and things like that. It was a lot of fun. And we still do grow potatoes, but matzah as a value-added product is something that is very special. And we were able to actually get a value-added producers grant from USDA to help us really kick it off. We did it on a very small scale the first couple of years, And then after we got this grant, we were able to expand and sell to retail outlets and really make it a more commercial production.
The matzah you make is shmura matzah, right?
Yeah, yeah. So that's a whole other thing. We basically, you know, learned everything on the spot, what needs to be done differently to protect it from becoming chametz and to ensure that it's kosher for Passover. And that, you know, that makes a ton of work compared to just plain growing grain for flour. But it was fun to learn. We had a lot of good guides along the way, and we still do. And it's a very special matzah.
So who buys it?
Whoever likes matzah. I mean, everybody. When we first started out, I would say most people who were buying it were people who were maybe using it just for the Seder, but not necessarily all week. And now we've seen, you know, the order size has gone up over the years. So you're seeing more and more people that either because they like it or because of demographic changes, I don't know, more people are finding out about it. People kind of stocking up for the whole week as opposed to just buying a box to put away. We're seeing less and less just 1 pound orders and more 2 to 10 pound orders.
Are the people who buy it local people, or can people order it online?
Yeah, people order online. We revamped our website this past winter. So it's yiddishfarm.org/farmstand, and that's where you could buy our products. And people are buying it locally. We have people in the next town over, Chester, that buy it. Secular people, religious people, everybody in between, non-Jewish neighbors love it. It's a very special product, and really the more and more people are finding out about it, and if it wasn't so darn expensive to make, I would be less risk averse to, you know, really boosting production a lot more beyond what we're doing now.
What other products do you have that you're selling online?
So we just added flour right now, and we're going to be adding different other kinds of flours coming up soon. Cookies and crackers are coming soon. We're actually in the process of, we were able to acquire a larger mill to make grinding the grain a lot more efficient. Our old mill was very inefficient. Because of how inefficient it was, it really only made sense to use it for Passover. But now with this new system we got, we're going to be able to make more products year round. So we're very excited about that. We're just setting up a room for it. So once we have the room built, then those other products will come online, and we'll start, you know, promoting it through our emails and website, Instagram, and all things like that.
When we first spoke, you had made pickles. Are you still making pickles?
No, I mean, my wife does here and there, like in the summer when we have like some cucumbers or like string beans and things like that. But yeah, we literally went through basically everything you could try to do with a farm, trying to figure out what would stick and what would have the most appeal and what would be the most fun and interesting for us. And it's just kept coming back to the grain as being the most obvious thing that we could be doing, that we're succeeding with.
Let's talk a little bit about the Yiddish language program. In 2012, you had 2-week immersion courses for beginners before they incorporated into farm life, which was totally in Yiddish. Is that still true?
Yeah, I mean, I would say even in 2012, they were coming out and helping in the garden and things like that, even before they were fully proficient. The program basically continued from the form it was in 2012, 2013, 14, 15, 16, 17, and then I want to say 18 was the last summer program we ran. We ran winter programs the winter of 2018 to 19, also kind of beginner Yiddish immersion. 2019, we decided, I mean, for a couple of reasons. One was just the funding landscape had changed. We weren't getting as many grants to support the program as we once were. A lot of the students that were applying weren't able to pay that year. And we've usually been able to, you know, give discounts or scholarships or things like that in past years. But the demand for funding was beyond what we could front. And then we also had a crazy situation in 2018 that forced us to reevaluate our student intake. Some people had lied on applications about their backgrounds, and it kind of took advantage of the program in a way that was very problematic. And then we were planning on bringing back the program in 2020, and then we got hit with the pandemic. So I'm actually speaking with one of our teachers this afternoon to try to plan something for this year now that vaccinations are kind of taking off. And my idea for this year's program is similar to past year's programs, but maybe a little bit more focus on farming skills. In the past, it was more of just like an outdoor classroom and here, learn some words here, maybe be on the garden for about an hour. But I think after the lockdown and quarantine and all these things people have been through for the years, like getting out and like learning how to drive a tractor or like, you know, running some kind of machinery or learning a little bit more the science of the crops and things like that would be a little bit more appealing than just sitting inside most of the day.
So. But everything, all the activities, all the farming activities has been and will be conducted in Yiddish?
Yes, yes, that won't change. And if you look back actually on YouTube to our founding conference in 2010, one of the things that we were founded to address was not necessarily beginners Yiddish education, but just what are all these beginners learning Yiddish going to actually do with this language, and where are they going to use it and have experiences in it and meet, you know, make friends and things like that. And the realizing that place is very important to that. So the Yiddish farm being a place where those things can happen, as opposed to only a place where people are going to just pick up basic skills and then go home, but rather being a place that people could use their language as a means to an end and not an end in itself.
Have there been any specific problems with the people who came with, say, different levels of Yiddish with communicating among themselves?
I'd say yes and no. So yes, insofar as when you force this kind of unnatural situation of people, you know, immersing themselves in a language that they're not fluent in and really pushing them to speak it when it might not be the easiest way to express themselves, that could lead to obviously miscommunications and maybe some tensions among participants that could have been avoided if, you know, if they could just switch over to English for a minute. And sometimes people are a little bit too strict. And, you know, we have rules here that basically say, like, you know, if there's an emergency or if having emotional stress or things like that, like, you could definitely take staff aside and talk to us in English and, you know, things like that. But sometimes students are like, feel like they're like failing if they do that, or, you know, so just kind of reminding people that it's the rule, you know, that the whole immersion thing is just to help them acquire the language. It's not like some like crazy stringency that they have to abide by at all times, or they're going to be disappointing, you know, themselves or others. So that, you know, I'd say that's been the most important thing to communicate to people. And sometimes people take it a little bit too seriously.
Can you tell us about the participants, where they come from, something about them, their ages?
People are from all over the place, all kinds of different backgrounds. There's no typical Yiddish student. To tell you the truth, most people that are learning Yiddish today have some kind of eccentricity about them. So we meet a lot of very interesting people. And we're still in contact with a lot of former alumni from even, you know, the summer of 2013, 2012. I mean, from those first years, from the secular to the Baal Tshuva, everybody and anybody shows up here. ages, we usually don't have children here unless they're with other family, but we have, I mean, our Yiddish teacher, Yankel Peretz, he's brought his younger siblings here. I want to say the youngest, maybe his brother was like 13 or 14 when he was here. And then the oldest, I believe, was 82. It was a professor from Santiago, Chile. He actually spoke Yiddish. I'm not sure why he was here. I think he was just here for the good time. He was here that first summer.
Do you still have formal Yiddish classes and at the same time people are doing farm work?
So like I said, the last formal class that we had done was in the winter of 2019. We're hoping to do programming this year. I don't know that it would be a beginner's course per se. It might be like a beginner intermediate this summer. But like I said, I'm talking to our teacher this afternoon and we're going to be updating our calendar in the coming days and weeks.
So let's say that somebody's really interested in going, but for whatever reason, they're unable to do heavy farm work. Do you have different kinds of work that people can do on the farm?
We've always had that situation in the past. Almost every group, anybody that's coming here, even volunteers, you know, we have tons of volunteers that come through. Some of them say, I'd love to volunteer, but like, I really can't, you know, pick anything up, or my back's bad. There's always something. We find always something for somebody to do. It's such a big place. There's so many different facets to it, that there's always something for somebody to do.
You touched on this briefly when you talked about the motorhomes. In 2012, you mostly had motorhomes, and I was wondering where people are staying now.
Yeah, so thank God we got rid of all those. And we've been working on the bungalows that are here on the property. There's still tremendous amounts of work to be done on them. It's always kind of a question whether it's worth it or not. But currently we have one guest bungalow that I would say qualifies as very nice. You know, air conditioning, you know, nice bathrooms, you know, hot water. I would say it's very nice. And then the other bungalows are still a work in progress. We try to explain in advance when we're doing our interviews with students, you know, that you're not coming to the Ritz-Carlton here. It's very rugged, but we have gotten one guest bungalow to a pretty good standard.
So how many people are usually there at once?
It depends. It depends on the program. It depends on the year. It depends on anything. I mean, most programs we aim for about 8 people. It's just because that the capacity of the programming space is just not that big. We've had programs as many as 20 people. It was just very cramped. It doesn't really make sense to have that many people. So we try to keep it around 8. This way everybody's comfortable. Everybody has personal space. There's enough space at the table. In the meantime, we've been doing, since 2012, we've been doing school groups and camps. And those numbers get into the thousands. I mean, we had a school group here that was once 800 kids at once.
Wow.
And those kids are all Yiddish speaking, coming from yeshivas and camps and schools. I'm in the area. Muncie, Monroe, the Catskills. We've gotten a couple groups from the city, and they're coming specifically to see the fields, the wheat, the potatoes, to learn about how things grow, what is organic. We kind of say we're the only like outdoor environmental education in Yiddish for Yiddish speaking children, probably anywhere. So in the world of nonprofits, it's always numbers, numbers, numbers. What's your impact? I'm not going to say that the impact for the Yiddish classes is nothing. We've had over 200 or 300 people come through our classes, but we've had over 6,000 or more people come through for our farm tours.
So are those groups for kids, are those day programs?
Yeah. So just logistically, it's a lot better for us. I mean, one of the things that I'd say is the biggest change from the beginning of our intensive Yiddish programming, so towards now, where we are doing a lot more of these day programs, is the energies that are required and the overhead costs and everything like that. So when I have a camp come, even if they're 800 people, I need one other person to help me. Their counselors are also there, so they're, you know, helping with keeping the kids safe and keeping an eye on everything. And they're here for an hour, maybe 2 hours, the most 3 hours. Depending on what they're looking for. Sometimes they bring lunch. Sometimes they bring other activities. We had a school from Williamsburg bring a helicopter one here. We work with them. We don't have to feed anybody. We don't have to coordinate sleeping arrangements. We don't have to, you know, there's no long interview process. It's more just like, this is what we're doing. This is the price. This is, you know, what do you want out of this? What are your kids learning at school that we can connect it to? It's, not easy, but it's a lot more straightforward and on our part. The Yiddish programming, when we first started, it was mostly run by single older bukhrim. Me and my friends, none of us were married yet, and we had unlimited time and energies. And as I have gotten older and married, and I have 3 kids, that same amount of energy is just not even available. So our programs have had to evolve with that change, that it's just not really possible to be only with the students until 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the morning, speaking Yiddish and correcting their Yiddish and doing activities and things like that. It's just not the same as, you know, the facts on the ground have changed.
Do you still have weekend cultural programs for the general public?
So again, yes, but it didn't happen last year because of the pandemic. So we're again trying to figure out the best and safest way to do that. And we're very happy that vaccinations literally just a week or two ago got opened up to everybody over 16 in New York. So that's, me and my wife are now fully vaccinated, and we're feeling a lot less stressed about how to do it the right way. We had family programming in a limited way last year with masks and distancing. It was just very difficult to do it in a fun way and also to get buy-in with people who aren't bought into the whole idea of masks and things like that. And it was very stressful. So this year we're very excited to have the vaccine available and be able to open up on weekends, Sundays to guests and people stopping by. And even this year, we've always had a demand for Friday afternoon programming for families, because in the local Jewish communities here, most kids are off from like noon on Fridays, and the parents, you know, you got 6 or 7 hours until Shabbos, and the parents are trying to figure out what to do with them all afternoon. And it's been especially when we were running, 14-week intensive programs, Friday was not the best day for people to come by because there was so much to do just to get ready for Shabbos. But now we're looking at that as a viable programming day, the Friday afternoons, people stopping by from local communities, and there is what to do here. There's plenty of activities, and so that's going to be something we're going to be adding to our calendar and advertising this summer.
What kind of activities?
Planting, taking care of the crops, harvesting, transplanting, even just running around the grounds. A lot of these kids bring bikes here. The closest Jewish community doesn't really have a park. So kind of already for years since we've been here, a lot of people have brought their kids from that community just to have a nice green place to walk around and to bring their bikes or whatever else, just because that space just doesn't even exist in the town that they live in. Just outdoor fun.
Your website talks about the possibility of tours and overnight stays, and we're all talking about post-pandemic here, and I was wondering if these overnight stays are just accommodations or activities, and what the volunteer opportunities are that you mentioned.
We kicked off the volunteering season right after Passover. There's a lot to do just to clean up the place from the winter. So the volunteer that came this past weekend was mostly just, cleaning up the programming space, filling some trays with soil. We plant everything inside first, and then in terms of the vegetables, and then we bring them out to the greenhouse and then bring them out to the field. The overnight stays, we haven't started yet, but it's usually families looking for a low-cost Shabbos getaway not so far from home. A lot of these hotels and things like that up in the Catskills are very, very expensive, and they don't really give you that much. We've been doing that for maybe since 2014, having families come, and that kind of fits in with more of a less top heavy in terms of a budget model, which is, families are coming, they're bringing their own linens, they're bringing their own food, and we're just providing the educational programming. We'll go for tours. If they stay till Sunday, they get a hayride, and they get to do some farm activities, and then Shabbos is just a beautiful place to be for Shabbos. And it's not so far from a lot of the places where people live, so it's not so much of a schlep to get here. And so far as, I'd say 95% of the people that are coming for that programming are also Yiddish speaking. So we're able to do all of our programming in Yiddish and kind of stick to that as a organizational value.
Where do you get most of your support from?
I'd say the majority right now, we have some foundational supporters that used to be like the Yiddishy foundations, now almost not at all. It's different foundations, people that like what we're doing in terms of working within the Jewish community, the farming aspect of things, the outdoor education, and then the rest of it is, it's kind of a breakdown between foundational support, matzah sales, programming, and individual donors. we need a lot more support. And we do not have the same funding that we used to have. And that's a big reason why we're not able to do as many or as intensive programming as we used to do, because it's just the money's not there. One thing we've noticed, and we've been critical of all these years since we were founded, is that Yiddish Farm does not hit the big highlighted goals of a lot of institutional funding mechanisms, such as like a federation or things like that. These organizations are not interested in Yiddish, or if they're interested in farming, they don't want it to have any to a traditional bent to it. There's a lot of contradictory requirements to be able to tap a lot of those bigger funders. So we're in a unique place. And we're also, insofar as we were getting funding from other places in the past, there's an assumption as well that once you're 10 years old, you figured it out. You have all the money you need. You have an endowment by then. You have your funders lined up and everything like that. And that's just not the case. I mean, there's tons of money out there from smaller organizations for startups and for startup endeavors and startup Jewish things. Oh, you're doing something with young Jews that's going to keep them engaged and things like that. Here's some money, you're a startup. But then once you graduate to the we exist already and we're good at what we're doing, well, why aren't you making, profit?
Every now and then I notice that I get an email from you saying, gee, we have this problem, we need help. Like you recently had a water main break and you said that you were able to get funding to fix it very quickly. How does that work?
Yes, I mean, we do have insurance here, but the deductible is rather high. So for a lot of smaller things, Yiddish Farm is kind of like a city that we have to take care of ourselves. When anything breaks, we have to take care of it ourselves. There's no real safety net unless it's a real major, major thing, and then the insurance will cover it if we're lucky. So I just needed to figure out how much the rental would be, and I called them, and they basically said, it's going to be about $600. And that's not in the budget. There's no money put away for things like that. So I just sent out an email saying, this is what, it's a pretty reasonable goal. Let's get $600 in a day to pay for this rental. And within a couple hours, we got enough donations to cover it. And some people are matzah customers. Some people are former students. Some people, I don't even know who they are. and this happens in the past. We'll just get, checks in the mail, and just somebody's name. We have to find them and find out how they heard about us. Maybe they read an article. Maybe they read something online. Maybe they heard from a friend. So generosity is kind of a real, real important thing to keep this organization going. It's always been. It does not sustain itself on its own. It requires this outside help.
We'll include a link to your webpage so that anybody who's interested either in participating or in helping or just in finding out more can go to you directly.
We're making a donation. We actually just got a new processor for our donations that allows for monthly repeating donations like they do on NPR. So we're very excited for that, and something, and people are already signing up for that. So that kind of sustaining support is really important, because this way we're not, scratching around every month. That makes it a lot easier to budget and to do the programming we want to be doing and be focused on what we want to be doing, which is not just trying to find money to fix problems, but actually running the educational program programming that defines us.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for this week. As always, we'd love to hear from you. So please email us any comments or suggestions or questions you'd like us to answer on the air. Our address is EnglishCorner@RadioSephirah.com. See you next week.